Every 4.5 days, a million new babies need to be fed around the world. Already, 1 billion humans are chronically malnourished. 16,000 infants starve daily. The UN population projections say there'll be 1 billion more people on the planet in 12 years. We could reach almost 11 billion by 2100, or maybe 15 billion, or maybe 6. Depends on the paths we follow in the years ahead. Ellen Weissman is author of Countdown, Our Last Best Hope for a Future on Earth. His previous book was the national bestseller, The World Without Us. Good to see you again.
Thanks.
In that book, you imagined what the world might be like if humans disappeared from the planet. In this book, you travel around talking to scientists who tell us what the world might be like with all these humans on the planet.
Well, you know, I wrote The World Without Us not because I really preferred a world without us. I sort of like to preserve my own species. And the idea was, you know, theoretically wipe us off the map, show how nature would bounce back swiftly without having to deal with our daily pressures. And I was hoping that readers would see this beautiful restored world and say, well, how do we add ourselves back into this picture? But then I ran into that statistic that you quoted at the beginning, that, you know, about every 4 to 4.5 days, there's 1 million more of us on the planet, did not seem sustainable. So I left that hanging at the end of The World Without Us, and a question of, is there something that we should or could do about that? And so many people were interested. Ultimately, it turned into Countdown.
Well, you know, as you've written in this book, and people have also talked about this, one way to reduce human population, educate and empower women, provide more access to contraceptives. But you have to make that argument to a whole group of people with different values. Can we do that?
Well, you know, I am a journalist. I don't make arguments. I sort of present stuff out there and let people figure it out. What I found when I went out there was, you know, the best contraception of all is educating a female. A girl who goes to school, she gets through high school. Chances are she comes out first she's deferred her childbearing during her studies, and then she's got something to do with her life that's interesting, that's useful, it's helpful to her family. She can help earn a living, but it's very difficult to do with 6 or 7 kids. But so most educated females tend to have 2 or fewer. And as for contraception, I think the reason I got into this book is that this is technology we already have. You know, you look at things like zero emission energy. We know how to do it to a certain extent, but the uptake is very slow. And there's some question as to how long it would take for us to have, you know, truly carbon-free energy, a real technological leap. But this is one that we already have, and it's cheap. For less money per year than the United States was spending per month in Iraq and Afghanistan, you know, slightly over $8 billion.
But it's a remarkably politicized issue.
Well, it is, but you'd be surprised, as I was, to find out how much momentum there is for it in this world. The United States, through USAID, is the biggest provider of contraception. And that continued even during the Bush years. Now, had the last presidential election turned out otherwise, Romney and Ryan were pretty clear that they would like to cut that largesse. But just to give you a sense of what it'd be like if they did, if they had, right now we're headed to 11 billion people by the end of this century. And that's dependent on today's level of providing contraception worldwide. And these supply lines are pretty fragile. And just us and a couple of other governments, a few foundations, if it were just a half a child per woman more, we'd be headed to 16 billion. But a half a child per woman less, if we did make that contraception available out there and let women decide for themselves, we'd be headed to 6 billion, which means that we'd be headed back in the direction of a sustainable population.
So in this book, you ask the 4 questions, which you started in Israel. I thought, oh, it's Passover.
Yeah.
You asked the 4 questions, and one of them was, how many people can the planet hold? What's the best science telling us right now?
Well, there's a few different ways of looking at it. One was to look at the way that we're growing food right now, which is force-feeding the land with chemistry, and this is starting to bite back. Artificial nitrogen fertilizer may be the most influential invention of all time. Before it, we were limited to the amount of plant life that nature could produce with a few legumes and other things that, whose bacteria at their roots could fix nitrogen. When we learned how to do that artificially, we just blew the lid off of what nature can do. Let's put it this way, 40% of us would not be here without artificial nitrogen. We couldn't be. But the downsides of it, you know, what it does to our rivers and streams, it leaves chunks the size of New Jersey dead in our oceans, and it sterilizes soils. We're not going to be able to keep doing it forever. It's also a potent greenhouse gas emitter when it breaks down into nitrous oxide, and also its fabrication releases a lot of carbon.
But, of course, you talk about the Green Revolution and what promise it held, and there is an argument that a new Green Revolution could be on the horizon with genetically engineered crops and genetically modified organisms. The Times today, the New York Times today, had an article about yeasts that were being engineered to produce saffron and vanilla, but easily could be engineered to probably produce, well, I don't know, easily produce other things as well.
Well, you know, these articles about what we can do technologically are quite marvelous. I read that article too, but you know, the Green Revolution is oftentimes touted as having refuted Malthus and Paul and Anne Ehrlich, who warned about famines because those famines didn't take place in the 1970s. But the founder of the Green Revolution, Norman Borlaug, when he won his Nobel Peace Prize, his speech concluded saying that we bought basically a generation of time. Unless we combine it with population control, we are going to be lost. I went to the Green Revolution centers. It's corn and wheat in Mexico and rice in the Philippines. And they all showed me their attempts to basically hot rod photosynthesis and give a lot more energy to plants. But they say this stuff is 20 to 25 years off, even if they can do it. And by then, we're going to have more than 2 billion people.
I like that phrase, hot rod photosynthesis.
Yeah.
Yeah, you mentioned Paul and Ann Ehrlich, and you talked about where Ehrlich is today and what he accomplished in his book, and how he was, yeah, for many years, people would dismiss him and think of him as a failed scientist. But you talk about how much the scientific community has honored his work right up until the present day.
Yeah, no scientist out there dismisses Paul Ehrlich. He's one of the great ecologists in the world. He's the winner of the Crawford Prize, which is Sweden's alternative Nobel, because there is no Nobel Prize in ecology. And, you know, he and his wife have been looking at this stuff forever, and nobody really can refute them. You know, there was an attempt once by the cornucopian economist Julian Simon. He had a couple of bets with the Ehrlichs. In fact, he wouldn't take the bet on environmental issues. But basically, Simon believed, and he actually said this, that, you know, human ingenuity will give us the resources to feed and clothe and take care of ourselves for the next 6 billion years, and the population could keep growing. The Ehrlichs did the math on what he was talking about. The population was growing then at 1.4%, and they said, probably not, because within just 6,000 years, the mass of humanity would equal the mass of the entire universe. But, you know, economists oftentimes love to believe this kind of stuff because nobody wants limits. You know, like every other organism, we were designed to make copies of ourselves. We've never run into limits before. But now, you know, we know that in a national park, you have to keep prey and predator in balance. Well, we now live in a parkland called Earth, and we're just not the dominant species. It has to get into balance with the rest of nature.
Well, the other thing you write about, Alan Weissman, in this book is 40% of the non-frozen land, as you put it, on the planet, used for food production now. But we do also need space for just the birds and the bees that we want to help us keep pollination going, keep our very crops healthy, besides all the other benefits you get from ecosystems. Any sense of what these scientists say about how much ecosystem, broadly speaking, is necessary?
Well, what they say is, unfortunately, in science, the only way to test out an idea is with an experimental group and a control group. That's called the scientific method. When we're talking about the environment, there's no control group. We're all part of the experiment. And the idea of pushing ever more species off this planet, as we are doing, an increasing rate of extinction, is playing Russian roulette, and we're putting more bullets into that chamber.
Paul Ehrlich, what did he say about how he views the future in terms of his children and his grandchildren, right? He was talking about his grandchildren.
Yeah. He is quite sobering about this question. He honestly doesn't know whether we are going to make it. But on the other hand, he hasn't given up. I mean, he goes all over the world and he talks about this. I traveled with one of his proteges to China and to Costa Rica. And she is the founder of something called the Natural Capital Project, which is showing us how humanity and nature can strike a balance. You know, in agricultural landscapes, turns out that production is much better if you leave some forest there and you leave the animals to do those nice things that you were talking about.
7 billion people today, 9.5 billion in 12 years, and then 11 or 15 by 2100 or 6. So you looked for an argument, a rational argument, or maybe a faith-based argument that people might embrace to convince them to go against sort of the biological imperative, having babies.
You know, I talked to holy people from every religion just about on the planet. I went to 21 countries for this. And part of the reason was that when people think about population management, they think about China's one-child policy. Nobody likes that. Even the Chinese don't like it all that much. And I found out that in all religions, there is something that accommodates the idea in times of need to, as it says in Ecclesiastes, to refrain from embracing so much. You know, think of the Old Testament. You know, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, they were polygamists for the same reason the Mormons were later. You know, you want to build a mighty nation by having a lot of kids. But then Jacob's son Joseph, one of his 13 children, very observant, realized we were entering a time of scarcity, and he holds himself to one wife, two kids, and he counsels the Israelites and the Pharaoh of Egypt that there is a time to conserve in order to save ourselves. And I think that we're talking about one of those times.
You put that to some Mormons that you were talking to in Utah.
Yeah, and it turns out there's even something in Mormon history. When polygamy was outlawed in the United States, the Mormons were still trying to be fruitful and multiply, but then a lot of Mormon women started to die in childbirth because they were having babies before their bodies had fully recovered. And it's a it's a family-based religion. This was really threatening their whole community. Fortunately, they're also strong on education. A generation of Mormon doctors told them that they had to start spacing their birth. So when I spoke to a bunch of Mormons, I said, you know, you just once did this to save your culture and to save your mothers. And now maybe Mother Nature is the mother that we all have to be saving. And, you know, those people were fully aware that Utah is in the Colorado River watershed, that the amount of available water is declining now precipitously, and this is something that we're just going to have to face in the future.
Well, a very rich book about this issue, Countdown, Alan Weisman, Our Last Best Hope for a Future on the Earth. Thank you.
Thank you.